Accession number 28361, Reel 4.
General Julian Thompson, Reel 4.
You were saying that you did two quite large exercises with troops. Where did the troops come from? Were they from Livingston or from...
Well, the troops came from two sources, actually. Mm. One of the exercises was done with troops who were at Bickley, at the Commando Training Centre, because in those days, when you went back to a commando having been away, you were put through a refresher course at Bickley. So that you might have got to Greenbury 10 years ago, but if you were going back to a commando having been at sea or doing something else, or at the depot, you had to do a refresher course. So the first exercise we did consisted of chaps who were doing their refresher course. So we had about 40 of them. So they were quite experienced chaps. I mean, we had 30-year-olds and chaps who'd been in Korea we had to command on this exercise. It was a very bad winter. This was, must have been February, I suppose, and the Dartmoor was absolutely thick with snow. All the leets and streams were frozen solid, and I can remember we were issued with hard-boiled eggs for our first day's rations, which when we opened them up for our lunch, they were frozen solid, and the water froze in our water bottles. It was that cold. And that exercise was quite hard because of the conditions. It didn't last all that long. It was only about 3 days.
Were you living in the field?
We're living in the field, yeah. We're living in the field. And then the other exercise, which was actually longer, was we used recruits from Livingston. And again, it poured with rain the whole time. That went on for 5 days on Dartmoor. Dartmoor weather was absolutely typical. It rained all the time. And both exercises you were doing... pretty basic platoon-level tactics in advance of contact, withdrawals, night patrols, and the whole thing was to be testing us, and we took it in turns to have the key slots in the organisation to test us in being platoon commanders, section commanders, platoon sergeants, etc. And we went round that two or three times, because there was enough time to put 14 people through that several times in the total of what it must have been about 8 days on the two exercises.
Changing appointments
all the time, yeah.
And the form of the exercise then would be attacking across the moor, then...
Yes. Can I just...
Yeah. Oh. Were these opposed exercises? Did you have a...
Yes, we had an enemy, but not particularly... large enemy, enough to give us a bit of opposition, yes. And it was all blank, it wasn't live firing.
Yes. Who provided the enemy?
Well, it was a demonstration platoon at Livingston, which did that, and provided the enemy for all sorts of exercises, yes.
So they were used to being...
They were used to being the enemy, yes.
Did they usually win, do you think?
Not always. The exercises were pretty... carefully controlled. I mean, they won if you got it wrong, and if you didn't do it right, then the DS would step in. They were heavily DS'd, these exercises. They weren't free play in the true sense of the word.
Now, you mentioned also doing toots. What sort of things were you considering when you were doing toots?
We were considering laying out a company in defence. River crossing, how do you get a company across a river, company in the attack with armour, company in withdrawal, relief in the line, as it was called in those days, all the phases of war.
When you were actually doing the exercises with the troops on the ground, was it all pure infantry work, or were you then thinking in terms, even notionally, of artillery support or naval gunfire support or air support?
It was pure infantry work, and quite honestly, because there were no guns or mortars or airplanes around, I don't remember us even having we didn't have an FOO with us to even sort of pretend we had guns, no.
Mm. What about on the toots? Did that bring
the toots, you did have to, you had to consider that, yes. You had to consider armour, artillery, air support, all the arms, yes, sappers, the lot, yes.
Had you ever actually been to visit Armoured or Sapper? Or
yes, one of the things we did in that period was to go and visit. We went to the School of Artillery, played rugger against the chaps there, had a guest night. We went to Chatham to visit the sappers, and we went to Bovingdon to visit the Armoured Corps. So we'd seen the kit, but we'd never used it.
So this is partly theoretical then, the tubes. So.
Oh, absolutely theoretical. Yes, I mean, you know, it was crossing the River X. What's your plan? How are you going to do it? Where are you going to start, etc.
Was all the tube work done in the southwest?
Yes.
You didn't go beyond.
I don't remember. It was all done round Exeter, but it wasn't done on training areas. That was the opportunity, of course, to get out of training areas. We were doing it on ground where farmers and landowners had allowed us to go. So we were actually. It was a break from being running around on Woodbury Common. You were actually doing the toot outside the boundaries of the training area.
New ground to consider.
New ground to consider, yeah.
And you mentioned classroom work. What was the classroom work about?
Well, classroom work was model exercises. Mm. So it was the traditional sort of progression. Mm. Well, it was traditional then, probably still the same, where there'd be a lecture about accompanying the attack, followed by model exercise about company attack, where you'd be posed problems and have to talk it through on a model. And then the next stage would be to toot it.
What sort of model was it? Was it a sand table?
It was a cloth model.
Cloth model.
Cloth model, yeah. Mm. Yeah.
Do you remember any of the problems specifically that you had to consider?
Not really, no. Not in detail, no. I can't remember the details of what the exact problems were, but all that I can remember is that we covered the various phases of war.
Mm. So you've done that. So this is in effect a troop commander's course.
Yeah, yeah.
What's the next stage after that?
Well, the next stage was the big deal was to go off to commandos, and we were then split up between the three commandos, which were all out in the canal zone at that time. We joined them in April 1954. Flew out in a York aeroplane, which was the first time I'd ever flown in an aeroplane in my life. Mm. Took quite a long time. Went via Malta. I remember the crew changed into RAF uniforms in Malta for some reason. I don't know, it was a charter aeroplane for some reason, because we were going into an operational zone was the reason given to us. I didn't quite understand the reason. They all wore RAF uniform from the leg between Malta and the canal zone. And we went into a transit camp. I can't remember where it was. And then the next morning, transport came down from the three commandos to pick us up and take us to the commandos we were joining.
Did you know when you were flying out which commando you were going to join?
Yes, I knew I was going to join 40 commando.
Did you have any choice or inclination in the matter?
No.
You were just sent?
Sent.
Mm. Flew in the transit camp overnight. What was the transit camp like?
It was a tented camp, dusty sort of place. Mm. Well, the tents were the old EPIPs, European Personnel Indian Pattern Tents. sort of dungy, they'd probably been there ever since before the Battle of Alamein, I think, probably. The washing facilities were outside, in sort of basins on racks. And you shouted for a chap to come and fill it up with hot water. And I think we were given breakfast. But we arrived there quite late at night and left after breakfast, and so really I don't remember much about it, other than them being in a tent and washing in a bowl outside.
You haven't really got a chance to get any impression of Egypt.
No, we got the impression of Egypt once we were in a jeep taking us up to to our commando. And I think we drove up, I don't know which road we drove up. There were two roads there, because there was the canal, which was the main waterway. Then there was the Sweetwater Canal, which had been built by de Lesseps to bring drinking water in for his labour force, which was tapped off the Nile. And so Sweetwater was comparative in that it wasn't salty, but if you fell into the Sweetwater Canal, you were told you'd be treated to a whole raft of injections to inoculate you against the diseases you were going to catch. and there were two roads. There was a canal road which went alongside the canal, and there was the Sweetwater Canal Road, which was inland a bit. And I can't remember which road we drove up. But the Sweetwater Canal, because of its nature, there were palm trees along it. Canal Road, it was just dusty, open, brown, by then getting quite hot, it's April, a lot of dust, glare in the sunlight, smell that you get in that part of the world, which was quite familiar to me, actually.
From India.
And after all, I was only then 19, and I'd left India when I was 11, which wasn't all that long before. It actually was quite exciting. It was a lot like coming home, I thought. It was fun.
What happened to you when you got to Fort Kamal?
Well, we arrived, and I was interviewed by the colonel and the adjutant. In those days, commanders were organized into rifle troops, which were rather like light companies. They were sort of two platoon strength companies, and they were called troops, not to be confused with the present commando troop, which is the same as a platoon, in which there are three in a rifle company. And my troop, which was a troop, was actually away, and so I was attached to support troop, i.e. the same as support company, which already had, of course, its officers.
And so you're supernumerary.
I was supernumerary until my troop reappeared. And so I was actually attached to support troop, which consisted in those days of the assault engineer platoon, the machine gun platoon, and the mortar platoon.
What equipment did the machine gun platoon
have? Right, machine gun platoon had the old Vickers machine gun, which fired Mark 8Z ammunition. The mortar platoon had 3-inch mortars, the old 3-inch mortars, and the assault engineers were like assault pioneers. And of course, they weren't using the Vickers or the mortars there. They were there in the internal security, IS role, as we used to call it in those days.
What was your A troop off doing then?
Well, the A troop, what had happened was that at that stage, the Queen was on her tour of the world in a liner, the name of which eludes me. And at that stage, she was arriving in the Mediterranean. This is now April, early May, 1954. And her cousin, Earl Mountbatten, was then the Commander-in-Chief Mediterranean. And he decided that he had a big sort of tamasha, parade, etc., royal review in Malta, when she arrived in Malta. Each commander had sent a troop back to Malta to take part in a grand parade with bands and you name it, the lot. So when I arrived, the troop was away in Malta doing that, which is why I was attached to support troop.
What did support troop do with you?
Well, what I did was, I was really supernumerary to one of the platoons, but because we were doing things like patrolling, that didn't matter because I had... I'd be sent out on patrol. And very soon after my arrival, we were sent to a big depot called El Kirsch, which was a huge ordnance depot. Because the canal zone in those days was a huge strategic base for the British. I mean, there were two infantry divisions there. There was the whole of the Commando Brigade, the whole of the 16 Para Brigade, plus, I think, at least one other independent brigade. There were huge numbers of troops there. And, of course, these depots had been set up in the days when, for the Second World War, and still existed, many of them, and were full of kit for the strategic reserve, ammunition, rations, weapons, spares, clothing. And they were pretty extensive. I can't remember exactly how big El Kirsch was, but it was something like 7 or 8 miles to drive round the perimeter of wire. And of course these depots were like lodestars to two sets of people there. One, Egyptians who would like to take raid it and take rations and watches and ammunition and weapons out, and also for the Fedayeen who are operating a terrorist campaign against the British occupation of Egypt, as they saw it. So our job was to prevent them from doing that.
Stop the terrorists and thieves.
Stop terrorists and thieves. Mm. And the way we did it was twofold. We'd have, because it was such a huge perimeter, we'd have some static positions which were manned by Mauritian guard regiments. These were Mauritian pioneers, and they manned the static positions. We provided the sort of reserve, which was in the form of Land Rover patrols inside the base to react to any incursions. And also, which was my troop commander dreamt up, and there's a story behind that, having ambushes outside the wire.
The Land Rovers, were they mobile? Were they driving around?
Yes, they would drive, stop, you'd get off. Mm. I mean, a typical tactic, you would drive along and you'd slow down and people would jump off and the Land Rover would keep going. And then you'd mount a snap ambush in a place for, say, an hour and then be picked up again and move on. I mean, I don't know if they were all that effective. I suppose they acted as a bit of a deterrent.
How many men could you get into a Land Rover for this sort of job?
Four. So you'd have two Land Rovers, you'd have eight people.
Mm. Going round...
as a pair, in bounds.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm. At night. I mean, it wasn't during the day, because by day the towers could see each other and see the ground. And of course there were lights as well. But there were dark patches, and also you needed to be in and out of all these complexes of sheds to try and stop people or catch people trying to break in.
Was the perimeter strongly wired?
It was wired quite strongly. There was a high fence, traditional, rather like a sort of stalag, you know, prison camp fence with lights on it. And then there was dannet wire, rolls of it, to thicken it up. And it wasn't all that good. You wouldn't have taken much to get through it, quite frankly. But as I say, in addition, and this way it comes to the business of mounting ambushes outside. During the war, the Second World War, to add extra protection to these dumps, there had been a program of laying anti-personnel mines outside, which were still there, unmarked.
Unmarked?
Unmarked.
How deep was the belt?
I don't know.
Did anybody know?
No. And when my troop commander came up with this brilliant idea of having ambushes outside, everyone said, I think that's a very bad idea. And the AE sergeant, who was an outspoken assault engineer, was an outspoken Irishman, you know, vented his view on what the stupidity of putting patrols into an unknown and unmarked minefield, and he was ignored. And I was tasked with taking one of these out. So I went, we did it on foot, of course. And so we trod warily and lay in this minefield for most of the night. And then the troop commander came to see us the next day in his jeep and went over a mine and had the tower blown off. And after that, there were no more patrols in the minefields.
While you were doing this patrolling, did you have any contacts with infiltrators?
No, I didn't personally. Other people did. I didn't know. No.
Was there any sort of background of intelligence?
No, the intelligence was very poor, as I perceived it. There were other patrols which were nothing to connect with El Kirsch. One of the favourite tricks, again, I think of people who just wanted to make money, was digging up the communications cables, because there was a lead in those days, there's high lead content in them. And so we used to have to mount cable patrols, and the favourite trick was to dig a hole here and then dig a hole there, cut the cable and then attach a car to it and pull a slice of cable out and rush off with it into the desert. And so we did those as well. I never did a cable patrol, but that was again... And then there were a lot of static guards on VPs, like bridges and key points. It was very much a static role. Tied up a hell of a lot of troops.
How large was your tactical area of responsibility then? You know,
well,
the commando's
area was not a tactical area of responsibility as I recall, in that you were required to dominate an area around your base. It was put a company or a troop into El Kirsch, put a troop onto the El Fadan Bridge, put a troop onto the water purification works, put a troop onto cable patrols. It was all tied to key points, as far as I could gather from my lowly level. And also escorts on convoys. I mean, every time you went anywhere, you had escorts. So if you sent men to the outdoor cinema two miles down the road, which they did in three tunners, there'd be escorts. When you went to collect the rations, there'd be escorts. When you went to collect the pay, there'd be escorts. So there was a huge bill in just keeping the show on the road, really.
Was there a large native population in the area to be watched as a sort of citizen?
In the towns, yes, but on the whole, the canal zone is not inhabited. Once you were, there were some villages, and then of course there were the major towns of Suez one end and Port Said the other, and Port Fuad on the other side of the canal. I only got into Suez later, into Port Said later, which I can talk about. The only contact I had, the only time I fired my weapon in anger in that particular tour, was when somebody tried to barge me off the road. That was a favourite trick of the chaps who didn't take kindly to us being there. And what they would do, and they killed quite a lot of people, you'd be driving along the road, and we drove on the right. And the chap would come up and try and barge you off into either the canal or, more usually, the Sweetwater Canal, because the road ran much closer to the Sweetwater Canal than it did to the Suez Canal. On the whole, it was quite a bit off from the Suez Canal. And or barge you off the road and cause you to crash. And you were allowed, under the rules then, you wouldn't be allowed it now, to shoot at them once they'd done that. And the object was trying to shoot their tires. And on this occasion, I was sitting in the front of a three-tonner. So there's the driver there, and I'm in the left-hand seat. And you probably remember the three-tonner has a hole through which you could go. And I looked out, and I saw this huge truck coming up alongside me. And the driver, who was, of course, near me, because he was sitting on grinned across at me. And then he went like that, and the driver, my driver, managed to hold it on, and then he sped off down the road. And I grabbed the driver's rifle, which was in the rack here, and then, realizing that with a pistol, what the hell was I going to do with a pistol, this chap taking off at high speed away down this straight road, I grabbed the driver's rifle. And to my fury, it was unloaded. So I grabbed five rounds from the bandolier that was hanging, loaded the rifle, and stuck my head out of the top. By which time the chap was quite a long way away. And the truck, and I said, come on, catch him up. The truck was doing this, you know, you can imagine.
Bouncing
along. And I tried to shoot his tires and fired about three rounds. And at that stage, he went into a village. Mm-hmm. And I saw all the people darting away as the rounds pinged off the road. And I thought, well, you know, don't do it here because you might kill an innocent person. In any case, he was drawing ahead. So we gave up the chase, and that was it. And I got back and I reported to the adjutant that I'd fired and the reason for it. And he said, that was, you know, you did the right thing, but you shouldn't have missed. That was it. That was the end of the incident.
Were you able to log a report which could have identified them?
No. The truck was a sort of battered old truck. I can't even, the numbers were in Arabic. Mm. The registration number was in Arabic, as far as I remember. In any case, I didn't think I could read it at the range he was at by the time I'd sort of gathered my wits.
Is this your first contact with a real live enemy?
This is my first contact with a real live enemy in quotation marks, yes.
What were you carrying in the truck when on this particular trip?
I think we had a bunch of chaps or something. I think there were some chaps in the back. Mm. We were driving from one of the sort of depots up in the north, down back to camp. It was just sort of routine, it was a typical sort of routine trip.
Were there any means to control vehicles moving on the roads, military police posts or...
There were checkpoints, yes. But there was not much, there was no control in the sense you had a radio and they could say, don't go to here, pick a different route. apart from this, there were only two routes.
Yes, you knew the two routes.
You could go either up and down the Canal Road or up and down the... there were places where you could join, of course, and you could come off and join one and go off to another, and I can't remember how frequent they were, but on the whole, once you were on that road, you were stuck with it.
What you mentioned the Mauritian guards. What impression did you get of them?
They were marvellous cooks. They were very efficient and very, very dedicated. They weren't highly trained soldiers or anything like that. They used to produce the most marvellous curries. And the big treat at El Kirsch, which was full of Mauritian guards, the officers used their mess, and they produced these wonderful, and they cooked terribly well. And, you know, it was French cuisine, and it was terrific. Much better food than back at our own place, which was ghastly.
What was your accommodation at the commandos?
It was in EPIPs.
You were in EPIPs?
EPIPs at El Bala, Sandy Camp El Bala. There was a sort of tin... I don't know what El Bala had been before the army moved in. There'd been something there, in that there was a sort of mud brick building, which looked like a reasonable sort of villa with a garden and a few sort of tin sheds around it, and commando headquarters was in that, but the officers' mess and the sergeant's mess and the troops' dining hall was in a tin hut of some kind. Whether that had been built for the army or had been there before, I don't know.
Who was actually giving the orders for putting guards on the vulnerable points and so forth? Was this coming down from headquarters of Middle East Land Forces to a general plan, or was it being done down through the commando brigade?
Well, our brigade was the 3rd Commando Brigade, which had three commandos, 40, 4-2 and 4-5 commandos. But in fact, 4-5 commando were detached, and they were up in Port Said and Port Fouad. So who they took their orders from, I don't know. Certainly not 3rd Commando Brigade. And as far as I remember, we and 4-2 commando took our orders from 3rd Commando Brigade. I wasn't really aware at that level of who was commanding who. I mean, there were a lot of the whole of the parachute brigade was there. Now, whether they ran their own affairs or whether the battalions were split around, I don't know, because I mean, in the next camp to us, we had 33rd Parachute Light Regiment, Royal Artillery, with their 75mm guns. Now, whether they took their orders from the local brigade or their own brigade, I have no idea. In a camp, again, not very far from us, we had the Highland Light Infantry. Now, whether they took their orders from 3rd Commando Brigade or another brigade, I have no idea.
What about you personally? How was your own life being ordered at that stage then? Was there a...
My own life was ordered by my troop commander, equals company commander.
And how did he run things? Did he have morning prayers or evening prayers every day, or did he have an ad hoc and informal way of deciding what he wanted to do? And
we had a sort of daily O group.
We had a daily
O group, as far as I remember.
Did that be morning or evening?
In the mornings.
In the morning.
Yeah. And then there'd be ad hoc stuff where if you suddenly there was a requirement for a patrol to go out at night, he'd call you in and say you ought to take that lot out and go and do your thing.
How did he conduct his O group? Was it done in a formal way according to a formula? Or was it done in a...
It was more in a sort of conference style, really, because he wasn't issuing formal orders.
Right.
He was just saying, he'd say, this has happened today, so you get the big picture, this is what's happened. Because there'd be a daily sitrep would come out, which would tell you what was happening in the whole zone, how many incidents there'd been, how many people had been killed, etc., etc. So you'd be told that. Then he would sort of focus down on what had been happening in the local area. Then he'd say, well, what we're going to be doing tonight, because he's usually talking about what's tonight, not than would be X, Y, and Z, and these are the patrols we're sending out, and there'll be the convoys going to X at such and such a time, and allocating responsibilities for doing that.
If you were sent out on a night patrol this time, what normally would be the objective or mission of the patrol?
The objective was to dominate the ground so that you didn't have infiltrators. And there was very rarely, I don't remember any intelligence saying, we think that, you know, Mohammed El Fayed and his gang were mounting an attack on El Kirsch tonight, therefore we've got to stop it. It was all sort of reactive stuff.